Our case for argument is Stevenson versus Levenhagen. Ms. Miklos?
May it please the court. This court should reverse the district court's conditional grant of a writ of habeas corpus and remand the case for adjudication of all of Stevenson's claims. The Indiana Supreme Court's holding that trial counsel's deficient performance failing to object to Stevenson being made to wear a stun belt under his clothes did not prejudice Stevenson is not contrary to, nor is it an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law in light of Holbrook v. Flynn, Estelle v. Williams, and Illinois v. State. The court found that an objection to the belt would have been overruled because the murders were related to organized drug activity.
I hate to shoot you down in mid-flight. But on page 6 of your brief, it says that, and I quote, it's the bottom of the page, at some point, either during or after the trial and for different reasons, four of the jurors came to assume that Stevenson was wearing a stun belt, but none of them actually saw it. Is the record silent on when they said they knew about it?
Yes, Your Honor. And one of those jurors actually said that she did not know whether she learned about it before or after the trial, and none of the other affidavits or the deposition was specific as to when they saw it, how, where they saw it, and at what time during the trial that they saw it.
Following up on Judge Bauer's question, these affidavits, I assume, were solicited by his lawyer.
Yes, Your Honor, during post-conviction.
Right. Well, I suppose I should ask them, but did they ask these people, the jurors, what their reaction was, what they thought it meant, or did it make them think that he was guilty, or do they think it's maybe routine that in any case involving violence you would have some kind of restraint on the...
That information specifically was not reflected in the deposition.
So no one asked them that, so we just don't know.
Well, one juror indicated... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So far as you know, nobody asked.
Right.
That's correct.
The record is silent on that subject anyway. Yeah.
That's correct, except for one juror's affidavit indicated that he assumed that Stevenson would be restrained in some way.
To control his behavior, yeah. Well, I thought what he said was that he thought a stun belt is to control the defendant's behavior.
That was at the end of the affidavit, Your Honor. I believe he saw what he believed to be a bulge. The defendant was wearing a loose shirt, and so he assumed, because he didn't see shackles or any form of visible restraint, that Stevenson would... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah. So in other words, this juror thought that a defendant would be restrained, and since there were no shackles and there was the bulge, he guessed it was a stun belt. Is that the thinking? Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. At most, we have two jurors that saw some sort of visual clue underneath the defendant's shirt, i.e. a bulge, and then assumed that he was wearing a stun belt for whatever reason. One juror actually saw some sort of television program before the trial about stun belts, and that's why he assumed it was a stun belt.
But there's no evidence of actual sight of the belt itself, just the sort of the outline of the...
That's correct, Your Honor. And
you don't have the belt with you, do you?
I don't, but there is a picture.
It's a shame. It would be nice to see a demonstration. Yeah.
There's an easy way to get it.
I may be wearing one right now, Your Honor, but there is a picture of this of a similar
right,
stun belt.
I've seen the pictures. I just wondered how a person... I suppose it would depend partly on the person's shape and posture and so on. Is Stevenson large or small? Or?
Your Honor, I don't know his physical attributes. I also do not know if he was made to wear it the entire trial. The Supreme Court indicates that the trial was over an 8-month period, and I'm assuming that is including voir dire. So it's just not sure at what point during this process he was seen.
The trial, well, presumably was interrupted a lot. 8-month trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
But
the actual taking of testimony, I believe, was about
150 days of testimony.
Taking your testimony was how long?
I believe was about just over 3 months. In the record, the judge says, okay, on the 95th day of trial, it wasn't clear to me if he was speaking about voir dire, including voir dire in that, but this was one, off the record, Your Honor, this was one of the longest trials in Indiana history, so it did span an enormous amount of time. And there is just no indication in these affidavits about when, at what point, these jurors came to assume that he was wearing some sort of restraint.
But now, so in Stevenson's brief, there's a long summary of evidence, which makes it look like a close case. And your reply brief, unless I missed something, you don't comment on that at all. Is the summary of evidence in the Stevenson brief accurate?
Your Honor, some of the sites were accurate, yes. The evidence was challenged. The state's evidence was challenged during the trial. But I believe that the way that her facts were written was more heavily in favor of the evidence trying to undermine the state's evidence, which was strong.
You didn't say that in your reply brief.
I included it's probably in the last paragraph, but I did not pick apart piece by piece each piece of evidence that was contrary to something that the state raised in its brief. But we do have one eyewitness and we have one witness that was there both before and after the murders.
Quite possibly the murderers, right?
No, Your Honor.
Is it really particular? Why is it more likely that he's the murderer than Mossberger or Funk? Are those the two candidates? Right.
Your Honor.
Because it seems to me they fingered him, but the evidence, you know, it's his gun, but it's another guy's ammunition and so on.
But sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, go ahead.
There was evidence that he had the gun just prior to the murder, so he did have
Oh, no, I know he
had
the gun. No,
and that was his gun. In essence,
he's using the other person's ammunition. I mean, so the other guy could have borrowed his gun and used his own ammunition.
In essence, though, we'd have to say that Mossberger and Funk somehow had some conspiracy to try to get John Stevenson. And although that was raised,
very natural.
All of those issues were before the jury, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor, that was raised.
What was the rest? So these two fellows testify, and obviously they'd be, you know, testified by ballistics people and coroners and so on. But how could it take 3 months of testing?
We better notify Judge Zagel to hang in there. He may have a wild downstairs.
It just is so strange.
The witnesses.
And you say it lasted 8 months. You mean there was a jury not sitting there every day, but there was a jury for 8 months. They were.
That's what the Indiana Supreme Court mentioned, and I believe it was either, well, Stevenson 1 or Stevenson 2, was that it was over, and it was in Stevenson 1 because they were talking about a point.
So maybe I'm going far afield, but I'm just curious. So if you had 3 months, 12 weeks, say 4 days a week, 48 days of testimony, what on earth could occupy 48 days of testimony?
These witnesses were thoroughly examined, and I read through both Funk and Mossberger's testimony and can attest to that. Especially in cross-examination, they were questioned about every word that they used and at what point they used it and in which statement, because they did give several statements to the police. There was even a deposition that the defense counsel took, and they were extremely critical about everything that was said. And
well,
at
wasn't
what point
there some
it was
controversy
said.
About the amount of time expended by the defense and the defense expenses related to this case?
Your Honor, I don't know about that. No, but the Indiana Supreme Court's decision does not hinge on whether the evidence was the best or not, but it is our contention that it is strong enough in light of not only what the jurors actually saw, but also in light of the jury instructions. The jury was instructed that they should presume Stevenson to be innocent, that the state must prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt, their decision must be based on evidence properly admitted at trial, their decision must not be based upon sympathy nor prejudice for or against Stevenson, and they should disregard any and all information derived from any other source. And so even if you find that the Indiana Supreme Court's cure of the failure to put the reasons on the record initially was improper, their ultimate decision that it was not prejudicial is also supported by what the jurors actually saw, the jury instructions, and also the strong evidence of his guilt.
Didn't the court indicate the reason it didn't think this was prejudicial was that they think an objection would have failed? The judge would have said, if his lawyer had objected, the judge would have said, no, I think this is fine, isn't it?
Yes, not only that, but that decision would have been upheld on appeal, and they looked at not only both...
Wasn't that kind of weak? Because one of the things the court said was that he had threatened a witness. Well, that's part of the crime, right? I mean,
well, he threatened Funk not only immediately...
It's not like threatening a witness. No, go ahead.
It was at several different points. He threatened him immediately after the crime. He threatened him in the days following the crime. And also during that time, he told Mossberger that he thought he was going to have to get rid of Funk because Funk might say something. So not only did it happen at the same, well, immediately following the crime, it also happened several days afterwards. And Stevenson even told Mossberger that he may have to kill the Martins in order to... I forget the exact words that he used, but he was looking to cover up his crime and thought he was going to have to get rid of some other people as well. So that was not just a threat immediately after the crime. It was something that persisted. And Funk even said that Stevenson would just come over to his house, and basically Funk felt like Stevenson was making sure that Funk was falling in line to enforce that threat, basically. So it wasn't just at the time of the crime. And there is no clearly established federal law that says that those reasons are unreasonable. There just isn't, it's not clearly established. And so the Indiana Supreme Court found those reasons, and there's nothing in federal law to say that those were contrary to anything else that had been decided.
Did Stevenson have a record of other violent crimes?
He did have a criminal record, Your Honor.
But did it include violent crimes or just drug?
As I stand here, I cannot remember whether it included violence.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was perhaps one other battery charge, but I cannot remember if that was reduced to a conviction. And there's no clearly established federal law saying that the reasons to support any kind of restraint or control of the defendant in the courtroom has to be related to some sort of specific violent action taken by the defendant within the courtroom or while he's in custody. There is not a first bite rule. The analysis more is there a potential for risk? Is it specific to this defendant to that trial? And the reasons enumerated by the Indiana Supreme Court fit that, certainly are not contrary to that standard. At most, reasonable jurists can disagree as to the level of prejudice suffered by a defendant wearing a stun belt that's underneath the clothes and is not specifically seen by the jury.
But the Indiana Supreme Court did find that the belt was readily visible.
They did, yes. They used that term, readily visible, which is used by this court and Roche as well. And I think it's important, though, for a prejudice analysis to look at, well, what actually did the jury see? Two of them saw some sort of visual clue and made assumptions based on a bulge and the fact that his shirt had been tucked in and was loosely draped behind his back, that he had to be wearing a stun belt. But there are a lot of inferences that can be drawn from something like that. And Holbrook v. Flynn certainly speaks about where there's a number of inferences that can be reached about something that's less prejudicial. In Holbrook v. Flynn, they were talking about security personnel being deployed in the courtroom and that there are several reasons why that may be so.
Is there some policy or practice on how many police officers or correctional officers would be in the courtroom in a capital case?
In Indiana, Your Honor? Yeah. I do not know that answer.
Do we know how many officers were in the courtroom?
I do not know. I know there was, when the evidence regarding the stun belt, I believe, they indicated that there was a correctional officer both behind and perhaps in front or to the side of Stevenson. So I know there were two officers that were in charge of the stun belt. I can't be any more clear than that, Your Honor. I see that my white light is up.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Nicholas. Ms. Donnelly?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. We think the District Court got it right. Everything that the Indiana Supreme Court said in their decision in this case, and it was a very lengthy analysis that they gave to this issue, were the first.
I don't understand why the jurors weren't asked what their reaction was to the, or maybe they were asked and didn't, but the affidavits don't give any indication of what inference they would have drawn. I mean, one inference would be, well, you know, violent crime is charged, the person's going to be, there's going to be some restraint, there are going to be shackles, or there are going to be a bunch of police officers or something that happens to be a stun belt. So how do we know that they draw some inference that must mean he's guilty or he's a mad dog, they're worried he's going to be get up and run out?
Well, I have three responses to that question. The first is that the U.S. Supreme Court has on three separate occasions...
has not addressed this issue, so go to your second reason.
The Strickland, this was a Strickland case, to prove prejudice under Strickland...
In the case. I'm interested in what you think. What I asked was, why weren't they asked what their reaction was, what they thought when they saw the stun belt?
Because we can't prove prejudice by putting up a juror to say that they were affected in a Strickland case. Strickland forbids it.
I don't understand that. If a juror said, well, when I saw the stun belt, I knew the guy was guilty. They wouldn't put a stun belt on a guy if he wasn't guilty, right? That's what a juror, I don't think so, but that's what a juror might think. So why don't you ask the juror, what do you think? Watch this TV program? Maybe in the TV program they put the stun belt on some mad dog or something, right? I mean, why wasn't there any follow-up?
My understanding was, and I was not representing him in state court, so didn't personally interview these jurors, but my understanding is under Indiana law, you cannot, this is would be considered impeaching the verdict.
The interviews?
The defense investigator did the interviews of the jurors.
That's not it.
I'm sorry.
Who was he?
Who was he?
Yeah. Was he identified in the record someplace?
He didn't testify. There were two people, actually.
No, I just asked, was he identified in the record as to who took the statements?
Is he identified in the record as to who took the statements?
There's three possible answers.
Yes.
His name, I don't know, or I'll go look.
Well, I know his name, but I don't recall him being named in the record.
Okay, so you don't know.
I don't know.
There you go. That's the third
answer. Okay, sorry. But
what do you mean? I don't know what you mean about impeaching or anything like that. The issue is, what is the prejudice from a stun belt, for knowing that someone's wearing a stun belt? And one way to explore the question would be ask the person, well, what do you think, or why do you think he had a stun belt? Asking the jury what the deliberations were, it's just, you know, what did you think when you saw he had this, or why did you think he had a stun belt?
Well, they did answer that question, and getting back to when you were questioning the state about this, I mean, the jurors did say, I mean, and I'm quoting from the affidavits here, during the trial is when they observed this. And the Indiana
during the trial?
During the trial, really? I became aware that John Stevenson was wearing a stun belt. That is the affidavit of Juror Bryant, Juror Reap. I was aware that John Stevenson was wearing a device that would prevent him from running out of the courtroom. During the trial, one of the jurors mentioned to me that Mr. Stevenson was wearing this device. Juror Hills affirmed that during the trial, I recall that Mr. Stevenson had some type of restraining device on him.
Right, and then a couple of them said they thought it was to control behavior, right?
Correct, and that's what the Indiana Supreme Court's factual finding was in this case, that Mr. Stevenson had proven by a preponderance of the evidence the jurors knew he was wearing a stun belt and recognized it for what it was.
Right, but the fact that a juror says, well, it doesn't really add anything. The purpose of a stun belt, obviously, is to prevent the person from running away or attacking the judge or the jurors or what have you. They know that. But I think if they'd just been, what do you think when you saw him wearing a stun belt? I would think that would be a useful question.
Well, it may be, but I think in Indiana that kind of evidence would not get in because I think...
I don't understand that at all. Why?
Because Strickland says that this is an objective standard. We don't look to the internal processes of the decision maker, that this is, it's objective. And there's also the language in Holbrook where they specifically say we shouldn't question the jurors about this because they may not even be aware of the effects it has. It's something that the court should look at objectively.
I don't know what objectively means.
Means the court looks at
instead of asking a juror, you imagine yourself being a juror? Is that what a judge is supposed to do? That's your idea of objectivity?
Well, I think that's...
If I were a juror and I saw a stun belt, what would I think?
I think that's the court's idea of objectivity.
That
I think that
sense.
They see a slippery slope where you can bring jurors in any Strickland case, and you can imagine them...
jurors in the sense that you got affidavits from. I'm just asking why you couldn't ask them one more question.
Obviously, they could have asked him one more question. I don't think it would have been admissible under Indiana law.
Capital case.
I'm sorry?
What would you prefer as a mode of restraint in a capital case?
I would prefer, and I think the law requires in a capital case, that a defendant, like any other criminal defendant, not be restrained at all. Unless there is...
Are there no police officers in the room?
Well, no. Of course there are police officers in the room.
Of course.
Well, in this case, there were police officers in the room. That's in the record, and that's it. I've never been to a criminal trial, any criminal trial, where they're not
so
some security.
That, presence of police officers is always adequate, and there's no need, and never a need for shackling or anything.
In most cases, unless there has been a determination, unless there's evidence, as there is in some cases, that a defendant poses a particular threat. That this defendant has, for example, there are cases where the defendant has threatened to escape.
So it seems normal to you to walk in a criminal court and see law enforcement people, their correctional officers, at the ready to grab a defendant if he starts to run, right? It seems pretty normal to you.
I think it seems normal, and I think the court said it was normal in Holbrook.
But it might seem odd to the jurors.
Well,
or it might seem normal.
Again, in Holbrook, the court said, no, that wasn't something. They compared the security in the courtroom to shackling, and they said when it's security in the courtroom, that may seem normal. It depends on how much security and how many people are there. Whereas shackling, it described as inherently prejudicial.
Are there any studies of jurors?
Any studies of jurors?
How jurors respond to different... there's a big academic literature on which they do things. They have mock trials, and they choose, they create demographically identical juries, and in one jury they'll have jury instruction, other they won't. Haven't there ever been any studies in which there were stun belts in one of the mock trials and there were police officers in another and shackles in a third?
I know there have been many, many studies, and I have read many, particularly those that concern capital cases, and I have never come across a study. I can't say there isn't one, but I have never come across a study that specifically tested what you just requested.
Would you have been content if he'd been shackled with a curtain on both the defense and the prosecutor's table so that the jurors couldn't see the shackles?
I think that he should not have been shackled or restrained in any way because there was no basis for
doing
so in this case.
What difference would it make? If the jury wasn't aware of it, who cares?
Well, if the jury wasn't aware, according to this court in Ringles, it doesn't matter.
Having the why wouldn't you endorse, as an alternative to a lot of police officers, having him shackled but not visible to the jury?
Because they shouldn't be shackled in the first place.
Why?
It is something we do
make.
Because it is something
irritating his ankles or something, right? I mean, what's the point? I don't understand you. The concern is prejudice. So if nobody knows that he's being restrained, what difference does it make?
Well, one of the concerns is prejudice, and the primary concern is the one that is at issue in this case, is that the jurors were aware that he was wearing a restraining device, and that undermines the presumption of innocence.
If they weren't aware, what difference would it make?
If they weren't aware, well, according to this court in Wrinkles, it doesn't matter. There are other factors that
why would you think it would matter?
Because he is expected to walk in there with the presumption of innocence. He hasn't been accused of a crime. Why shackle him if there's no reason? He's just like shackling me. I mean,
that doesn't make any sense.
Well,
you don't reverse a conviction because someone was shackled and nobody saw it. That didn't make sense.
Well, and fortunately, we're not in a position to have to ask you to do that, because in this case, it is very clear that the court made a clear, unequivocal finding that
you're arguing really is maybe these people should be able to bring some kind of civil rights suit. They shouldn't be shackled. But if there's no prejudice, you can't reverse the conviction.
If there's no prejudice under this claim, you could not reverse his conviction. But we definitely believe there is prejudice in this case. This was the court was clear and unequivocal that the jurors were aware of the restraining device in this case. They said clearly that they were not refusing, that Stevenson's failure to show prejudice was not the result of overwhelming evidence of guilt. They said that. They took the time to say that. This is a case that the evidence is close, and we do not look at the evidence and when we're assessing Strickland prejudice in the light most favorable to the state. We do not look at a statement of facts that is only...
And judging from the length of the trial, the defense lawyer was extremely tenacious in his cross-examination. And
he was tenacious,
and
I believe.
He's not criticized, I take it, for anything other than the failure to object.
During the guilt phase of the trial, no. They are alleged ineffective for failing to present any evidence at the penalty phase. But at the guilt phase, no. They were not criticized for what they did. They presented a very vigorous defense. It was very much contested. And the question is, could this practice, a practice that the Supreme Court has repeatedly described as inherently prejudicial, one that is known to undermine the presumption of innocence, have affected the outcome in a case where the evidence was this close? We look at the nature of the error. We look at the weight of the evidence. And in this case, both factors demonstrate that there was a reasonable probability the outcome would have been different in this case.
Mm-hmm. Anything further?
If the court has no further questions, then we ask respectfully that you affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you very much, Ms. Donnelly.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Miklos?
Your Honor, I have no
rebuttal. Oh, okay, but I have a question for you. Wouldn't a preferable method of restraint be the shackles with the curtains so that the jurors don't see the shackles?
As opposed to the stun belt that John Stevenson was...
No. If I recall correctly, pardon me for interrupting, the stun belt was used to avoid the shackles.
That's right. It was a preventative measure worn underneath the clothes that was not to be seen by the jury.
But the shackles are not... I mean, as I understand what they do with the shackling, I'm Judge Tinder and Judge Bauer have more experience than I do, but my impression was they bring the person into the courtroom before the jury is brought in, and he sits at the defense table, and there's a curtain... And there should also be a curtain at the prosecutor's table. And as a result, nobody can see his shackles. And he's not getting up and walking, you know, unless it's pro se. He has no occasion to leave the table, unless, you know, when they have breaks and the jury is out of the room. So why isn't that preferable? Because then there's no possibility of prejudice.
I disagree. I think a jury could assume, well, we see skirts around the table. We haven't seen the defendant move. He must be shackled underneath.
But nobody at the table is moving except the lawyer who's examining or cross-examining.
I think that's the difficulty you get in when you're looking at different visual clues but not actually seeing the restraint.
The defendant would never get up during the trial.
How many lawyers were present at the table in this case? Do you know?
I don't know.
It was two.
I know he had
didn't
two.
Didn't he have two counsel?
He had two counsel. I don't. That spoke on
so
the record.
Two,
I don't know.
Two on each side. So there's more than one lawyer jumping around.
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't know if a jury would be savvy enough to know that a defendant wouldn't be able to move at any point during a trial or during a break or a recess.
During a break, when the jury is out, it doesn't matter, right?
Correct.
It's only when the jury is there.
For example, during a long sidebar that the parties
but
could be having.
You have a criminal defendant popping up during a sidebar. I mean, that does not, That's not how it works. He sits there. If he starts popping up, the police officers are going to get very anxious.
I think the difference, too, with shackles is that his body, his posture, the way he's sitting is going to be very restrained, whereas with the stun belt, you don't have that same kind of physical restraint. It's the potential that he is going to be controlled by the stun belt.
Well, when you're shackled, you don't have your ankles touching each other. Otherwise, you couldn't walk into the room, right?
They're close, but they are not touching each other. And perhaps even the defendant
to walk. He walks into the courtroom. He's not carried. So there's space between his two feet, right? Otherwise, he couldn't walk. He'd be hopping.
Of course, that creates a little noise, too, when they sit at the table. If they jiggle their foot, you can hear the chain rattle.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's a little awkward.
And perhaps a jury could pick up a clue that the way the defendant leaned in to talk to his defense attorney was restricted and that the bottom half of him didn't move, and therefore he must be shackled underneath the skirt.
Does Indiana still use the stun belt?
No, it has been prohibited.
What do they do now?
Well, they use other forms of restraint.
Like what? What are the other forms?
Your Honor, I don't know that question right now.
Okay. Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. McClose and Ms. Donnelly, and of course, your appointed counsel, I'm sure. And so we thank you for your very vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. We thank the state as well. And the court will be in recess. Thank you.